it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Rack and Yak.
It's time for What Mark Heard on Saturday Suckage with Mark Grody and Steve Rosenblum.
Boy, everyone is stupid except me.
Indeed. Time for our near award-winning segment, What Mark Heard. Mark, what did you heard?
Well, first I should let people know that one thing we heard on Inside the Clubhouse today was that Eloy Jimenez, in his rehab starts coming back from the pectoral injury, will be the designated hitter today, but the plan right now is to have him play defense tomorrow, which suggests the White Sox might play him in left field still when he returns, despite having had all sorts of troubles out there. Yesterday, I heard White Sox broadcaster from NBC Sports Chicago, Steve Stone, on with the Bernstein and Rahimi show Monday through Friday, 9 to noon here on The Score. And he was discussing Eloy Jimenez in some very real, I don't know if you say harsh terms, but here is Steve Stone on Eloy Jimenez.
The number one priority of this team is not what's best for Eloy. The number one priority of this team, Kenny Williams, Rick Hahn, Jeremy Haber, Mike Shirley, who's getting ready for this draft, the number one priority is winning this year. And if Eloy is one of the tools to do that, then that's great. And if he's not, well, they're going to go after it and try to win without him, because they're doing a pretty good job without him to this point. So that's where he has to understand where he fits in the grand scheme of things. Everything is secondary on an individual basis behind the team goals.
Right. So you can want what you want, but it's you best fall in line with a team that is really good. And before you react, Steve, let me just play, because these two cuts kind of go together. Here's Eloy Jimenez discussing the possibility of being a DH or playing defense. Here's Eloy.
If they need me, I'm going to do whatever, but I still don't like DH, so keep it in mind.
Okay, he doesn't like it. But
so keep in mind. With what? Who's working for whom here? That's exactly Steve Stone's point, right?
Right. And, you know, there's more to it. It was a really long cut, and we weren't going to take 5 minutes to play everything that Stone said. But, you know, I mean, he has hurt this team with his defensive play, and then has hurt his team by getting injured because of his defensive play. So I understand why he wants to play defense. I'm glad he wants to play defense. You know, like, you shouldn't want to sit on the bench and play half a game. I get it. But just understand, and Eloy knows this, he's going to make his money in Major League Baseball because he's a hitter, and it's never been because of his defensive prowess.
When you walk that up, talking about his injury and his return and setting everything up about he's going to be playing defense, and I just, in his return, I just imagine the baseball Henny Youngman joke. Doctor, will I ever be able to play defense again? Well, yes, great, because I never could before. that's what hit me. And he doesn't, did Eloy sound to you like a guy that with whom the White Sox had fixed stupid? Can they fix stupid? Does he sound like a guy who understands exactly what Steve Stone was saying and the importance of him being healthy?
Like, he's just, I don't know anything. I can't infer anything from anything that Eloy has ever said, because it's all in the same happy, smiley tone. So, like, he just seems, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know Eloy. Nobody really knows Eloy. He's like Ernie Banks, right? It's just, he just says sort of the same things every time he talks, and he does it with a smile, and he does it in a fun way. And that's okay. But I can't, don't ask me to infer anything from what Eloy is saying. But I guess we can, that he says he wants. Just so you know, I don't want to be just a DH. But I do think I think it's going to be a case where they will occasionally play him on defense, but I think that the Sox obviously know that they can't do this, you know, 3-4 times a week. They can't. Right?
I don't know what they have planned, but letting him go out there even once and risking further injury, I mean, this is like baseball malpractice. You can't do that. Maybe they're trying to humor him. Yeah, we're not making you a full-time DH right now. But why not? What's best for the team, the way Steve Stone said it? What's best? We're trying to win the World Series. We're not trying to let you play at recess. Not everybody gets to play every position. You do what we need. And it's malpractice on the White Sox part to let him go out there with a glove, because he's not in the best position to help you. And you're supposed to put your players in the best position to succeed. How does Eloy Jimenez playing left field put the White Sox in the best position to succeed?
Right. World Series teams don't develop players at the major league level. And that's essentially what you'd be doing, right? I mean, they've had to do that with, throwing Andrew Vaughn out there, who's comported himself just fine. So, but yeah, typically that's not part of the blueprint. You don't just bring a guy up and develop him when a team has got serious adult business going on. And that's what the Sox do. Right. Unless there's anything else on that, Steve? Shall we move on?
Well, I would like to add that it's getting maddening that Eloy, like you said, Grody, I appreciate that he wants to play the field.
Sure.
But, bro, you're not good at it, and you keep getting hurt. Just at some point, you have to realize it's not going to happen. It's like in Mean Girls, stop trying to make fetch happen. Stop trying to learn to play the field and just go hit the baseball.
And we're not even mad at you that you can't play the field. Yeah, it's okay.
We never wanted. We never expected you to.
Right.
You're just here. You were there to survive out there. But, and I understand that this team is full of guys that can play DH. But you know what? It's a grand surprise that Andrew Vaughn's a pretty competent left fielder. So there's less room to make at that DH spot. So it's just, that's all I want to say. It's getting maddening. Like, at some point, you just got to say, listen, Eloy, you're not doing it anymore. Take the glove out of his hands.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So let us move on now. Let's move on to a moment in the Cubs game yesterday. This was in the fourth inning. It's Cubs-Cardinals. It's Luis Garcia pitching. It's Wilson Contreras at the plate.
Here's the 0-2 pitch to Contreras. Look out! Contreras gets hit in the helmet, and I think he's okay. Contreras hit the deck. He's all right. He talks to Molina, and Contreras is all right. He is being looked at by the trainer. PJ Mainville hustles out.
So that it looked awful. That's a 95-mile-per-hour fastball square in the head of Wilson Contreras. Pat Hughes called it perfectly because Wilson Contreras was okay somehow. He managed to stay in the game. He never did leave the game. And so that's what it was. But watching that, my first reaction was, get this guy out of the game, Luis Garcia. It's an 0-2 pitch. I get it. He was not trying to hit Wilson Contreras in the head. I don't even know if he was trying to come inside. And that almost makes it worse, because if you got a guy who is that dangerous out there on the mound that he hits a guy square in the head, I think there should be a rule where a pitcher is automatically ejected for that. Like, that has to be a penalty beyond just the guy trotting to first base. Like, that's just, it's, and to, he was gone after that inning. Was Luis Garcia, but I think there needs to be something implemented. Like, as long as we're doing all these rule changes,
trash panda.
Guy hits you in the head, get him the hell out.
Yes.
I can't
you
hear.
You all right, Steve?
Now can I can. Now I did. I lost it. I tried to redial. I tried to get back. Oh, my God. Okay.
Wow. Oh, okay. Did you hear my diatribe, or did you hear any of that?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. It was a good mark.
Well, I thought it was pretty good.
We just redo the whole thing,
Steve
then?
Heard. Sure.
Okay, so I'll give you the thumbnail version. We're talking about Luis Garcia of the Cardinals hitting Wilson Contreras in the head with a 95-mile-per-hour fastball yesterday. And us sucking. There is that. And I think that pitchers that do that should be ejected from the game immediately, just for the safety of everybody. And if a ball gets away from, like I said, he wasn't trying to hit him. It's an 0-2 count. It's Cubs Cardinals. I don't have any intent. Like, I don't think he had intention at all. And Luis Garcia might be a great guy, but guess what? That's a dangerous player right there. Get him out of the game. And luckily the manager did eventually take him out of the game. He didn't stay in. But I just think, so in regards to that, you can't leave a pitcher in there who hits a guy in the head with a 95-mile-per-hour fastball.
So it is dangerous. It's the head. That's where you're.
Yep.
Whether by accident or by intent.
Right. Yeah, I don't think he had intent to hit him. I really don't. Like, I got nothing against Luis Garcia, and I don't know if he tried to throw inside, and that's what makes it worse, is that he had no control. If you have no control to the point where you're hitting a guy in the head with 95, get him out of there.
Well, that's part of this. Somehow they're going to wrangle the whole sticky stuff argument to be about that.
Well, that's
that.
Fine, too. And then, yeah, I mean, that's cool.
Steve, I don't know if you saw yesterday on the Twitter when Grody tweeted this take. One of the responses he got was, this is the worst take on Twitter today. So that's where Twitter stands on the matter.
Where do you stand on it, Studs?
I'm with you. Like, I maybe not quite like that. You know what? Yeah, I do agree with you. It's too dangerous. And I get that there was an intent, but you know, I mean, come on, man, he could have really been hurt. I mean, obviously they wear helmets for a reason, right?
Yeah.
And the helmet did its job, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't mean like, yeah, you're right. Like, hey, all right, buddy, you're out of here. Like, you can't like just get out.
He's having a bad day. It's like a basketball player falling out of the game. I mean, there has to be something more to it. There have to be some sort of ramifications for that. And somebody, 312, totally ridiculous. What if it's 85? Yeah, if it's 85, too. That hurts as well if he gets him in the face.
Still hurts.
I think you can take a note, a rare
spasm of hockey knowing what it's doing. Any stick foul to the head could be an ejection. It certainly is a penalty. You get your stick up around a guy's face, I think you should be ejected. But sometimes the game moves so fast, and the stick might have been aimed at his, you know, cross check his shoulder, and suddenly he ducks down, he tries to get around, he hits it with his head. But clearly, when you're targeting the head, you're gone. That's it. Football.
Yeah.
If you're targeting the head in college, they'll throw you out. Now they've done a bad job. They didn't necessarily mean to do it.
But yeah, you've got to go.
There's no reason not to throw out. First of all, it's gutless to throw at a hitter, and it's gutless, and it's not fair that hitters get to wear all of that armor up to the plate. I just think that's crap. Take everything off your arms and your elbows and your hands and all that, and then go ahead and lean over the plate. I dare you to. And if a player throws it, if a pitcher throws at a player's head, you're gone. It's just that simple.
Yeah.
You can't duck into it the way some guys would want to duck into it. Oh, look, you threw at my head. No, you didn't. You started at 5'8", and you ducked down to you were 4'8", so we're not counting that. But I think bottom line, I think you're right. And we've seen other sports take that seriously, and I just think the whole idea of hitting a... You know, when Ozzy wanted to throw at Donaldson, right? Wasn't that Ozzy's response? You were on my team. That's gutless. The whole idea of throwing at somebody is gutless. Even 85, like that's a changeup. All right, Texter, you can stand up there and we'll throw 85 at your ribs. How you fix for that?
Yeah, and I know a lot of the people that came, and some people are calling me soft on Twitter yesterday, and I think that it's more of a higher concept with people, like they don't want more rules, and I get that because I know that that gets really exhausting when we're changing rules and we're doing things, but I don't know. Like I said, there are ramifications for physical penalties in all sports, and I think that when you get hit in the head, it should go beyond a guy getting to take first base. It has to be in a jet. Hey, sorry, kid. You don't. Something's very dangerous about the way you're throwing the baseball today. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get fined anything like that. You could pitch tomorrow, But for today, goodbye.
Now, we have a texter, 815 texter, says it's a byproduct of the sticky stuff band, LOL. Well, that seems to be a teaching moment. If it is, indeed, a byproduct of the sticky stuff band, then you're going to have to learn how to pitch. Not just throw as hard as you possibly can for as long as you possibly can. You're going to have to learn how to pitch. You're going to have to learn how to think. You're going to have to learn how to take stuff off your pitches and not just the sticky stuff. You're going to have to put it back on. You're going to have to spot it. You're going to have to become a pitcher. You're not going to just be able to throw 100 miles an hour wherever it goes because that's what you did. You're going to have to learn something. I think that makes you a better player. It might take longer to get to the majors than just being having a power arm. But you know what? You'd be a better player when you get there, and that's what the majors should demand.
Yeah, and I think it was Torrey Hunter I heard on with Parkins and Spiegel, and he said something to the effect of, I don't want the pitchers to not have any kind of sticky stuff or any kind of grip because of stuff like that. Like, they don't want to see pitchers come out wild and frightening as Luis Garcia was yesterday. I have no idea if it had anything to do with the sticky stuff. Probably not. It just seemed like it got away from him. And like I said, innocently. Doesn't matter.
But the premise of that is all wrong. Pitchers are not entitled to just rear back and throw as hard as they want wherever it goes, and I need sticky stuff to give me some control. No, you are responsible for your arm. You're responsible for where your pitch goes. You don't get a free pass. It's just stupid. That presumption, however Torrey Hunter said it, and it is not aimed at him, but there are people who say that, well, this gives them control. No, you're in charge of your control. And no one guaranteed you the inalienable right to throw 100 miles an hour no matter where it goes. That's crap. You're responsible for becoming a professional at your job. And now the profession says you're not going to be able to do it with sticky stuff. That doesn't mean you're guaranteed throwing 100 miles an hour or even 95. You don't have to. Kyle Hendricks showed you, you don't have to. You become a pitcher. That's what you're forced to do. Okay? That's the way it always, seemed to be. The idea that you should be guaranteed the right to throw as hard as you can. If you can control it, throw it. Be that way. But if you can't, have a seat.
Right. And to the 206, I know it makes people feel good to call people soft. I get it. I hope that was satisfying for you. But you'd have a puddle coming out of your pant leg if a ball came high and tight to you. But I do hope you feel better. I know that feels good.
I watched a video. It was like a TikTok video of like the perspective of someone, the from right behind the catcher, perspective of someone taking 100 mile an hour fastball. And I don't remember if it was high inside or, and it doesn't matter where the ball was. It was terrifying just to watch, alone stand in the box against that. So, yeah, if you get anywhere near my head, I'm going to think, yeah, you know what? I'm sure you didn't mean to do that, but maybe get out of here and learn and throw the ball over the plate.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're, or if you get hit in the head, you should be allowed to throw the bat at a defenseless pitcher.
Right, sorry, I wasn't trying to do that bat to slip out.
Yeah, well, sorry, I'm trying to throw this bat at you.
Does it go the other way?
Like Addison Russell used to always do. Addison Russell should have probably been ejected.
Yeah.
Remember he used to do that constantly? He would just fling the bat.
It was like every at bat, he's losing the bat. Like, what are you doing, man?
Yeah, have a seat, Addison.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to throw a bat at him. Give me old Betsy. She's 44. She's a 42 by 44. We're just flinging this thing. We're throwing a tree trunk at you. Should we take a break and come back with more of what Mark heard?
Let's do it.
Let's do that. So, I don't know. Hopefully I can stay wired in for this. So I'd like to hear. I'm sorry. Mr. Rand, but I'm looking
Don't be soft,
to
Steve. Stop being soft.
I am. Yeah, I am. I'm sorry. I don't want to be soft because we don't want to be soft. We want to be able to we want to be able to take 100-mile-an-hour pitches in the head because that makes, yeah, that's baseball.
Lenny Dykstra, we're nails, man. Nails. Nails, bro.
No, I'm meringue. I'm freely admitting it. I'm Steve Rosenblum. He's Mark Grody. Soft, strong, tough, whatever.
Soft.
Yeah. Okay. Chicago Sports Radio is 670 The Score.
If I think something sucks, I'll tell you it sucks.
All right, we got another member of the Saturday Suckage Club, Don Koopa.
Don Koopa.
Welcome in, welcome back. Saturday Suckage, of course. So Pitching Ninja was sent out this video of Michael Kopech from last night, and he said, "K-ing the side with complete filth." And I'm thinking, Trash Panda's dad would have played in a band named "K-ing the side with complete filth."
Totally. That sounds like something. Yeah, that sounds like something. I could see it.
Actually, just one word, filth. That'd be a great name for a band, wouldn't it? Just filth.
Yeah.
Like
here we
filter.
Go.
Filth.
All right. We are continuing with our new award-winning segment, What Mark Heard, here on The Score. Mark,
all right, let's continue on with the Cubs and specifically Jed Hoyer. I know we talked a lot about this in the first part of the show, but let's hear it actually from Jed Hoyer's mouth. Jed, of course, the president of baseball operations for the Chicago Cubs. And let's hear him try to discuss why this isn't, or this, he says this isn't like 2012 and that rebuild. Listen to Jed.
Every situation is different, and I think that you know, we're in a different situation now than we were in 2012. And so the decisions we're making, the processes we're going through are completely different. So I think that label is certainly something to be avoided. I think that people talk about rebuilds when you're doing what we did in 2012. And like I said, we are going to have roster turnover. We need to do that. That, I think, like I said, that was inevitable. You control guys for 6 or 7 years, and you know that it doesn't last forever. As far as that initial club control, so we'll have turnover. But yeah, I think this is certainly not a rebuild by any kind of definition that we'd be using from our past.
I mean, he's right with some of that, in that like the actual physical structures in which the Cubs worked, including Wrigley Field, to their minor league facilities, were complete garbage, and the way they did business was bad. So those are things that they will not now have to literally rebuild in this particular portion of Chicago Cubs baseball. But, you know, the cupboard was dry then. It's not like the minor league system is particularly fortified right now. You still don't have any starting pitchers this side of Kyle Hendricks and occasionally Zach Davies. And if you're trading your core guys, it is different, but not that different.
I whatever his barometer is, everybody's got their different connotation of what a rebuild is. And
right.
We talked with Gonzo, and you had mentioned it earlier about the, well, do they have to lose 100 games, and that's the official rebuild? That's the scary R word. I don't know if you're trading guys who are your core, your World Series heroes, and nothing so immediate to replace them, and your last deal showed you, okay, we're trading our Cy Young runner-up, and we're getting four guys that you got to take the Dairy Queen after a game, then it kind of tells me you're rebuilding. You're not building for next year. But who knows? You could trade these guys and re-sign them. If suddenly money springs loose, if suddenly the Cubs, as Tony Andracki said earlier, he writes for Marquee, covers the Cubs for Marquee, that Marquee becomes a profit center like they envisioned. And suddenly you can trade Javi Baez and then re-sign him. Okay. Well, then you've got prospects, and you lost him for 2 months of a season you'd given up on anyways. That's fine. So I guess you could say it's not a rebuild. You can be Jed and say, we don't like that word. You and I can look at it and say this smells like a rebuild. I guess until we see what they do before the start of next season, we'll wait to see the label it until then, I guess.
Did Jed Hoyer ever give, I'm thinking back now, did Hoyer ever give it any, or what was Jed Hoyer's explanation for the Yu Darvish trade? Because if that wasn't like the first move in a rebuild, then it was a salary dump. right? So either are things, both are things that they would not want to admit. I don't remember. I honestly don't remember how
we have the audio. Jed Hoyer, Darvish deal was not about finances. So will you guys want that?
Yeah, what was it about? I don't remember.
All right, well, let's find out.
Sometimes you have to make really hard decisions in these jobs, and you have to do things that maybe in the moment aren't as popular. And I think that that's fine. You know, so I look at it like, you know, I think that, you know, when we've been lauded, oftentimes it's been that's been scary to me. And so I'm really excited about the return. Like I said, I think we got are able to really jumpstart our farm system in a big way. And we're excited to get those guys in our player development system and work with them. So, you know, as far as financially motivated, you know, that wasn't the focus. I do feel like, you know, in this environment and really in every transaction you ever make, I mean, this is a business and we always have an eye on the finances of every deal. I feel like, you know, in 2020, obviously, some of those things are magnified, but, you know, that was not the focus. The focus of this deal was to try to, you know, move a player in the second half of his contract and try to acquire a lot of young talent. Like I said, we don't have many opportunities to do that. Look back on the last 6 years, like when have we had a chance to replenish in any way? And this was an opportunity to do that. And we took it and we're excited about what we got back.
Liar, liar, plants for hire.
Yeah, I mean, that's rebuilding, replenishing. So he's talking, and he said it's not about finance, it's about replenishing, which is about rebuilding. So I'm glad I got to hear
it. It's about finances. You get out from under a contract in the second half of a contract. He said that.
Yeah, which one would they prefer to admit?
Yeah.
Just, later on, they don't want to admit either.
It's a load of crap. But whatever. They did it.
There's no.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what we call it or what he calls it. It matters what they do with it. So we'll see what happens.
I got one more cut, and it's Jed Hoyer, the last Jed Hoyer cut. And that's him. What's going on? What are you doing? What are you up to in this process?
I've been talking to teams for the last month, so I think that, you know, it's probably pretty consistent. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, pretty much talked to everyone. And I think with the draft coming up, there was a lot of chatter prior to the draft, knowing that, like, this is a busy period, you know, working through the draft. And, yeah, I'll be on the phone a lot in the next 3 weeks.
Well, the draft is your territory, Steve, so I won't step on your toes on that. But, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the way – what did Gonzo say? A top what player –
Top 75 player.
Top 75 player is what they should allow for if they were to trade Chris Bryant. A top set, not a top 10, anybody in the top 75 they should not turn down. So that's a lot of calls.
It is, and when he says that, a month ago he was calling likely to improve the team. Improve a team that was in first place. Now he's not. So those phone calls have changed when he calls, says he was talking for the last month, because a month ago they were faking like they were good.
Don't you think that a part of this, like some of this was made easier for Jed Hoyer? He's never going to say that. And it probably has been agonizing to lose an 11 in a row, but something definitive happened as opposed to being a middling, like, you know, two games out or one game in front or whatever the case, like that was more complicated than this. At least there is something definite that has happened that we all see and that Jed Hoyer admitted that he sees too. That 2 weeks ago they were talking about buying. Were they? You know, or was like quietly and privately is Jed like, okay, this is kind of what I thought. We have something definitive now, and now we can move forward that the fan base will get it. I feel better about it. Everybody kind of, while it sucks and nobody liked it and it was agonizing to lose 11 in a row, or was it 12? Now we know what we have to do. Whereas before you didn't.
Right. Before he was swerving, the team was swerving all over the road. Now they've got an off-ramp, and they chose the let's make a deal off-ramp, and here we go. And he opened, you know, they're open for business. Let's start a bidding war. What am I offered for these guys? That's the way he's choosing to do business. But you're right. It clarified things. They picked a lane, and that lane sucked. That's where they are. Mm-hmm. So that's what he's doing. You know, what he does with it, I don't know. And I don't doubt that he's been on the phone with a whole bunch of teams, but those phone calls changed. That's what wasn't said, because he was seemingly looking to buy, improve. What can we do here? How do we maintain this? But even when they were in first place, I know we talked about this on the show, their record was fourth best in the NL West. So you were a first place team in the Central, and you would have been behind the top three teams in the West. So That's yep. not.
There's that thing. Yeah.
Yeah. The all of California. You're behind all of California, the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Padres. And you were in first place, and your record was worse than the entire state of the National League state of California. So right. I think you're right. He knew what he had.
Yeah.
And he was surprised that they weren't that team earlier. But they showed their hand in time. You know, imagine if this happens April or August 2nd. Oh, my God. Right? You didn't do anything? You tried to improve it? And like, oh, now we prove we really suck.
Right. And that is why Hoyer can lament it all he wants. At least he knows the business model has been created for him. You can get on the phones. Patrick Wisdom can hit cleanup for you. And there you go.
There you go. All right. Ryan LaHair, All-Star.
Yeah. Okay. That's what we're talking about.
When Dave Wegman comes back, we have a little bit of, we're going to share some things. We're going to sort of split up the what are you doing Wegner duties. And Jed Hoyer was on with Lawrence Holmes on Friday. And there's part of it we want to bring you. I know you've heard a lot of Jed today, but it's an interesting way to present it when he was just one-on-one with Lawrence Holmes. So what are you doing, Wegner, is next. We've got that for you before we close out the show at the top of the hour. Steve Rosenblum, Mark Rohde, Saturday Suckage. Of course, we've proven it again. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
What are you doing, Wegner?
Back.
We're back, Stevie Sunshine. You with us?
Made a pit stop. Welcome in, welcome back, Steve Rosenblum. It's Saturday Suckage. Look, we're going to tell you.
I know. You got to do what you got to do in this world.
Yeah, right. You do. And I did. And what are you doing, Wagner? So we talked about it last Monday when we did our 5-hour suckathon.
Yeah.
The Tampa Bay mayor called her shot. She was saying, as the Lightning had taken a 3-0 lead in 3-0 lead over the Montreal Canadiens, if the Lightning could just give the Canadiens a little bit of a break, then the Lightning could come home and win Game 5 and win the Stanley Cup on home ice. And that's exactly what happened. Montreal won a game, and all the fans were happy in Montreal, and they won the game. They won game. The Lightning came on to win game five, and they won the Stanley Cup. They went back to back, and the star of the whole thing, in case you missed it, Tampa Bay winger Nikita Kucherov he shows up shirtless, championship cap backward, big smile, clapping his hands, raising two fingers, ordering people to fetch him champagne, and this was some of the highlights of his post-game presser. Or not.
Boy, this is good. This
Lightning,
is good stuff.
We have Nikita Kucherov. Media, please raise your hand if you have a question. We'll start with Joe Smith, The Athletic.
Joe, let's hear it.
How would you describe your congratulations? How would you describe your emotions right now after doing what you guys did?
I don't know what to say. Back to back, and yeah, I couldn't sleep for three nights, you know. And to be able to win this game is huge. Wesley was outstanding, MVP. I was telling him every day, Wesley, you MVP, you're the best player. And then they gave it to whatever the guy in Vegas, the Vezina. And then last year they gave Vezina to somebody else. Number one bull. Wesley took.
It's hockey, baby.
I love that. Number one bull. It's just great. And he's right, talking about Vasilevsky. Kucherov himself could have won the Conn Smythe. Anyways, that was the highlight, and the shirtless Nikita Kucherov with the post-game presser for the ages.
This is hilarious. Steve Stone told a great story yesterday in regards to Steve. You know that Steve Stone used to work on Monday Night Baseball on ABC, right?
Oh yes, that's where it's where I remember him on him and Howard Cosell next to each other. That's what I remember.
Yes, and Al Michaels, too. So Stoney was on the score yesterday. It was with Bernstein and Rahimi. And he told the story about the complications of working with the great Howard Cosell. And his friend in this case was Al Michaels. Here is Stoney. Enjoy.
So in the production meeting before that game that I did in Boston, I was talking about the platoon of the left field, Rick Miller and Reed Nichols. Reed Nichols, a right-hander, Rick Miller, a left-hander.
And later, a White Sox outfielder, Reed Nichols.
Yes, yeah. And they platooned them, and that was one of the first, like, everyday platoons they had kind of deal. And I told the story of Joe Torre talking to me as when I was a player, when Joe was with the Mets and I was a player with the Cubs, the Mets manager was a guy by the name of Joe Frazier. And Joe comes running by, and he says, taps me on the shoulder because I played against Joe when I first came up with the Giants. And he goes, can you believe I'm not playing today? I'm not playing because you guys are throwing a right-hand pitcher. He goes, I got 2,500-plus hits. You think I got some of them against a right-hand pitcher? I said, Joe, I think you got a few against a right-hand pitcher. I believe you got a few against me. So, yeah, I think sometimes the platoon system gets carried away. And I told this story in the production meeting. So now we're doing the ball game, and all of a sudden they flip-flop. Reed Nichols, he leaves. Rick Miller comes in. And Howard goes, reminds me of the time when then manager Joe Frazier was, and he tells the story.
Your story.
He tells my story.
That's
and then he goes,
up.
Steve, what do you think about that? And I just said, nice story, Howard. That was it. I mean, you know, and then I learned that, you know, if I want to have one of these, you know, to myself and my research and everything else or my history, I would keep it to myself if I were around Howard. So that's what I learned.
And Al Michaels had warned Steve Stone of the complications of working with Howard Cosell for those very specific things.
Oh, my God. That is a great story. Howard Cosell was a kingmaker,
yes,
because of Monday Night Football. And
right,
whatever he deigned to do, and there you heard such exasperation from Dandy Don Meredith, who and he's surrounded by athletes. Dandy Don and then the GIF replaced Keith Jackson as the play-by-play guy. And it was such a thing. Howard became a big thing because bars would show Monday Night Football and allow you to throw a brick through a TV when Howard came on. You could pay to throw a brick through a screen. And he was a kingmaker, and I knew Steve. I've never asked Steve about working with, but now I got an idea of what it's like working with Howard Cosell. And
none of the stories are good from anybody in regards to it. Like, ask Bob Costas. Hated him for some of the things that
Costas.
He said. So I don't know. Bob Costas, a tornado. So,
Costas. By the way, this leftover note from Champa Bay.
Yeah.
Now that's what they're calling it.
Right, Bay. Champa Bay. Yep.
That night, among everything that's going on, the Stanley Cup, which has a Twitter account, tweeted something. Okay, you kind of expect that. It's Stanley Cup's being awarded. However, this Twitter account tweeted something at Tom Brady. He tweeted out, FYI, I'm too heavy to throw at Tom Brady. That's what this in Champa Bay. To which Brady Brady retweeted, IDK, everything feels a bit lighter after some tequila.
Yeah, they're having another boat party on Monday, right, Stevie?
Yes, that's right. He plays it. He leans right into it. I'm loving this version of Brady.
I do too.
It really bothers me that Tom Brady is so good at so many things, and then joined Twitter and is immediately great at that too. Like, come on, man. Is there one thing that I can be better at him? That, like, I mean, come on, ridiculous.
Nope.
He's great at golf. He's just
you're a good runner, guys. Studs. You're a good runner, man.
He can probably field run better than me, too.
How about field dressing varmint?
Yeah.
How about field dressing?
I guarantee he would be better than that. Better. Like, I guarantee it. He's just one of those guys that, like, I have a friend that's like this, too. He's just great at everything he does. Like, there's not a single thing he's bad at.
He field dresses and cooks it on the spot and eats it.
Yes.
And he's got vegetables to go with it.
Yep. Okay.
My turn?
Yeah, your turn.
All right, I got a quickie here. So this is a deluxe music note here. This is from the website The Delight, and it lists, according to The Delight, the top live band, the top 10, I'm going to give you, live bands of all time. All time, Stevie Sunshine. Number 10, U2. Number 9, Jimi Hendrix. Number 8, Bruce Springsteen. Number 7, Metallica. Number 6, Stone. I can't do it like you do it. Do it.
Stones.
That's it. Number 5, AC/DC. Number 4, The Whom. Number 3,
The Whom.
The Whom.
The Whom. Wait, I got a question. We're reading, yeah, before we get to the big finish.
The tell.
Based on what are the criteria? Based on what? Live bands?
I don't know. I didn't read that close.
Let me put together a list.
Yeah, they put together. Yeah, you know I love my lists. yes, and by the way, let me put a list together. The podcast is back up and running. But anyway, no, they listed these and they gave like two or three paragraphs on each on why. So I didn't really want to get into all of that because the time dictates that I shouldn't. It's so subjective. That's why I'm kind of racing through it. But so number 4, The Who. Number 3, Pink Floyd. Number 2, Led Zeppelin and Trash Panda. Let's hear number 1. Queen! According to The Delight, Queen, the number one live band of all time. And if you've seen the movie, Freddie Mercury was, or you didn't have to see the movie, maybe you just know Queen, Freddie Mercury, quite the showman. There's no doubt
they were.
About that. But your guys, the Doors, I think, were like 14 on this list. My guys, Pearl Jam, were 17, so...
Concerts stepped up their game far after the Doors, and the Stones, to their credit, stayed with them. So Stones. All right. Well, who can argue with Freddie Mercury? There you go. All right. We are going to thank you for listening to Saturday Suckage and What Are You Doing, Wagner, and What Mark Heard and everything else, all the other nonsense. We suck so you don't have to. We will now be bringing you part of an interview that Jed Hoyer did. He called up Lawrence Holmes and said, Lawrence, we need to talk. And Lawrence said, I'm here for you. And his microphone was open. So this was heard yesterday on The Score. Thank you. Be well, be safe, and if nobody important listened, we'll be back with Saturday Suckage next week. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
And we've got the president of baseball operations for the Chicago Cubs with us right now. Jed Hoyer joins me on The Score hotline, which is presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. Jed, I appreciate you picking up the phone, man. Thanks so much for joining me.
No, anytime, anytime.
All right, so... what have the last 2 weeks been like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said it yesterday. I think that, you know, it's been probably the most sort of professionally frustrating, you know, 2 weeks I can ever remember, you know. I feel like, you know, we sort of started this two-week period. You know, we had a brutal June. I think we survived it fairly well. We were still in first place. You know, we had the no-hitter. And then it's like just a extreme change of, you know, playing pretty well, surviving this brutal stretch and, you know, multiple West Coast trips and a single trip to New York. And like this month that looked like this gauntlet, we were surviving okay. And then, you know, we sort of got to mile 20 of that marathon and just fell apart. You know, I feel like we lost a bunch of games that we had a chance to win. We just couldn't sort of get a big hit at the right moment. And then we lost a bunch of games in, you know, pretty awful, you know, spectacular fashion where we end up, you know, having Eric Sogard pitching. So, and the combination of the, you know, incredibly painful losses by one run, I think the, you know, the Eric Sogard pitching losses that are painful for, you know, non-competitive reasons. And then you take the totality of that and, you know, that equals up to an 11-game losing streak. I mean, with a group of players that are just, you know, simply too talented to have an 11-game losing streak. And I think, you know, we had a 12-game losing streak, which was the longest we've had here, you know, in 2012, you know, that was a team that was, you know, that was rebuilding, that was, you know, sort of under-talented, and you weren't entirely shocked that could happen. But, you know, having an 11-game losing streak with a team of this quality. The team that started that stretch in first place, it was something that was, I mean, totally unexpected and shocking.
I think that it's fair for any Cubs fan to look and say, okay, I mean, there's probably going to be changes. But I also think, to be fair to you, I think that there's a huge difference between what you and Theo walked into when you got here versus where things are now. So that I can more clearly state this, how would you say things are different now than what they were when you walked in the door?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when we walked in 2012, you know, I think we realized that this was going to be a really long process to get good, and we just didn't feel like we had, you know, the right pieces together. We needed to sort of, you know, gather a wave of prospects and bring in through slowly. And, you know, to be honest, when we sort of embarked on that plan, and it wasn't the plan we had coming in, but it was more of the plan we realized we needed to do once we assessed things. You know, when we did that, you know, we actually probably got through it faster than we thought. You know, I think we ended up winning 97 games in 2015. I think that, you know, we would not have expected that at the time. We felt like we're going through a pretty long rebuilding process. And now I think with the, you know, with the players we have and stuff like that, I don't see any reason why this needs to be, you know, a long process like that. That was very different. We didn't have any building blocks on the team at that point that we knew about. And so it was a much longer process. I think now, not only with what we have already internally, but also with, you know, the kind of trends in the game, you know, that's not something that we're about to embark on.
How do you compartmentalize what the guys on your roster that will be coveted, what they've done for this franchise versus how you go about trying to build the next great Cubs team?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to do what you just said. I think you have to compartmentalize it. And I think, you know, obviously we have a ton of guys that obviously did something that hasn't been done here. You know, in 108 years. And I think that, you know, obviously you'd never want to lose sight of that. It's not only the World Series, but also just a lot of really competitive seasons and, you know, some really high highs and some, you know, obviously, you know, tough losses in the playoffs or at the end of the year. But like this group, you know, as a whole has been, you know, wildly successful. I think that you certainly want to honor what they've done. I think, you know, these are iconic players. I'm looking out at, you know, Gallagher Way right now from my office, and there's, you know, plenty of jerseys of guys that, you know, helped us win the World Series and are fan favorites. But ultimately, you know, my job is, you know, to do what I think is the right thing for, you know, the health of this franchise. And, you know, I want to make sure that we can build, you know, that next great Cubs team. And I think when you look at, you know, service time of players, you know, we always talked about, you know, we had a window where we had these players that were young and inexpensive, and they got more expensive through arbitration, and then some of these guys hit free agency. And, you know, realistically, we've been probably the most stable roster in baseball over the last 7 years. We've had the same guys. That lack of turnover is really rare, and I think we have some inevitable turnover that's probably going to happen now with guys hitting free agency and guys getting a little bit older. You know, we need to, it's a young person's game. We need to make sure we have a lot of young talent, and we need to make sure that we're not afraid of roster turnover, you know, based on sentimentality. We have to think about, you know, what is the right thing for this organization long term.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.